¿eh?
Okay. Hello and welcome to the Action Button Entertainment podcast. This is our first episode. It is something of a spin-off of the Insert Credit podcast, much in the same way that actionbutton.net was a spin-off of insertcredit.com, except rather than waiting several years to spin off into a separate thing, we're doing it after only 2 months. So what the Action Button Entertainment podcast is all about is we focus on one game per episode, whereas the Insert Credit podcast is 10 topics that we discuss for 6 minutes at a time at a frantic pace with a large panel of 4, 5, 3 people. This podcast is just three of us, and all the 10 topics are related to one game. And there's no terrifying buzzer sound like in the Insert Credit podcast. We're just kind of chilled out talking about a video game. And for today's inaugural episode, we figure let's go ahead and talk about the video game that many people out there might have been their first video game. I say that without a hint of facetiousness. I'm pretty sure a lot of people listening to this, Final Fantasy VII was the first video game that they really loved. I mean, do you guys think that's too bizarre of a claim to make?
Oh no, definitely not.
Pretty reasonable.
I don't. It's either that or Super Mario 64. I got started with the Grand Prix on the Atari 2600. That was my first. Oh man, video games are so cool. And then Shoplifter. I was like, oh my god, video games are amazing. And then Super Mario Brothers. But anyway, I'm Tim Rogers, the founder of ActionButton.net, and with me tonight are Alex Jaffe.
Hey, my first game that really blew my mind was Link's Awakening.
Link's Awakening is fantastic. We should talk about that one someday. And also Vito Giswaldi.
Hey now, I guess mine would probably be Zelda, the original Legend of Zelda.
Oh, well, look at you, Mr. One-Upmanship.
Well, hey, it was a great... I played that game a lot.
Now... Vito, yeah. How old are you? You're 26?
I am somewhere around there. I don't like to disclose my exact age.
Oh, well, we'll just pretend that I don't have a photographic memory. And Jaffe, how old are you?
I am 23.
23. So I am I'm 33 years old. I'm not married.
Why not, Tim?
I spent 6 hours last night playing Final Fantasy VII with a large pair of $300 headphones on a 70-inch television. So,
so the new PC version that came out?
No, I'm playing it on the PSN.
Oh, because the new PC one came out. That's why it's on everybody's tongue, right?
Yeah, it's got achievements in it.
Apparently, really?
I haven't looked at the achievements.
What would they be?
I feel like they could monetize the game if they just like charged like pay a dollar to level Cloud up to level 10.
Yeah.
I mean, they did that for Mega Man X for the iPhone and iPad, and people went nuts.
Yeah, exactly. The the level curves, the experience curves in the Final Fantasy games are just ripe for monetization. And I say this as a non-evil person. I say this as a person who leveled up all my characters and killed the impossible bosses in Final Fantasy VII back, you know, in 1997. So, I mean, I was 18 years old and I wasn't having sex or anything. So I was all, you know, I was like, well, let's play Final Fantasy VII. And I really beat the heck out of that game. And I leveled all my characters up using the old time-honored method of put a lot of time into it, you know? And it's like, if I could go back and just pay a dollar to level my guys up 10 levels, you know, and then pay another dollar to level the guys up 3 more levels or something.
That's kind of sad, though, when you think about it.
It is. It is. But it's like, because I just want to kind of get through the game.
Yeah, I mean, I have a DS cartridge of one of the Dragon Quest games, and I'm just stuck on the final boss because it's clear the game wants me to go level, like, 10 more levels.
Yeah.
And it's Dragon Quest, so that means that's, like, what, like an 8-hour commitment to get 10 levels?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, in a Dragon Quest, grinding is part of the game because you have to buy new stuff, right?
Yeah.
And in Final Fantasy VII, and I say this with utmost admiration to the game, like, I say that it's just a cool world to hang out in, you know, and you kind of want to hang out until the end of that cool world in the game. I don't even really care about playing the game, and I understand that that got the writer of the Mass Effect games a lot of hate over Twitter because she said, I wish you could just skip the combat parts. And it's like, and I mean, I've been playing the game for several weeks. I'm writing a detailed design analysis for a Gamasutra.com, so I'm like taking notes on the math of the game.
Now, Jaffe has somehow never played Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, I never played Final Fantasy VII, and I have 10 questions for you based on that that you can answer for a person who has never played this game.
I have a question for you. How did you not play Final Fantasy VII?
Well, we'll get into that.
He's 20 years old. He was 8 when it came out. Think of it that way.
He's not that much younger than me, and I played the damn thing when it came out. I told my dad, I'm like, hey, go to the store, you get me that PlayStation for my birthday.
You were 11. You were as old as I was when the first Final Fantasy came out in the U.S.
Well, I had a choice between a Nintendo 64 and a PlayStation, and we'll get into why and how I made that choice later in the podcast.
It better be Pokemon Snap.
Anyway,
it should have been.
I guess
the only excuse.
I guess we get into this now. And,
all right. Here's our first question.
Hey, I was going to... Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm kind of used to this. I'm the host of the Insert Credit podcast, so I got to back off and...
Got to step off the reins, let him... Yeah. So,
podcast is about drinking energy drinks and talking very loudly, very quickly. This podcast is... I'm drinking a cup of herbal tea right now, so I mean, you know...
So slow it down.
Let's slow it down.
As opposed to 5 p.m. So, anyway, Jaffe, why don't you start with your questions?
Sure thing, Tim. Explain to me the plot of Final Fantasy VII in 6 minutes.
That's pretty good. The plot of Final Fantasy VII. Okay, so Final Fantasy VII, which is kind of rare and weird for a Final Fantasy game, you're terrorists in the game, right? Would you agree that's the word, Vito?
Yeah, well, they use that word, don't they?
They actually use the word terrorists of a group called Avalanche. Avalanche being in all capital letters, and that's apparently a real...
Not an acronym for anything.
Yeah, but if it were, I don't even want to start thinking, oh my god, my brain is a... You know, I scored...
Got 6 minutes, let's go.
...tests as a kid, so my brain is right now screaming through hilarious acronyms for Avalanche.
We're going to waste a minute on this alone.
Stuck again, Mom.
Okay, so Avalanche, they're a terrorist group. You start off the game, you're on a train, very important. You're blowing up stuff to save the planet because these big reactors are sapping the life force. The Mako. Mako?
Mako is like, in Japanese, it's like magic energy. It literally means it's like
Mako.
A force of the earth, right? And so there's a company called the Shinra Corporation that is running these giant reactors. And you destroy one of their reactors and thus become known terrorists. And you escape to the slums. There's a really neat scene on a train. And you're in the slums and you're running away from the evil Shinra corporate. They have like a private military. Like they're kind of chasing you. Their military is called Soldier, which is also all capital letters and not an acronym. And you escape through the slums where you meet some magical fairy girl. Well, she's not a fairy girl. She's like just some girl who has magic powers naturally and lives. She's like some sort of holy spirit Miyazaki movie character kind of girl. And her name is Eris. And
so you meet Eris, you rescue her. Actually, you fall into her church, then you guys run away from Shinra.
And you find out not only is Shinra chasing you, they're also trying to get her.
So. Yeah, so you got to help her. And then what happens? And they're it's like Cloud's in a dress at some point.
There's like a whole bunch of stuff. You're running away from these troops all through these slums in this really big kind of slum. There's some sort of
blight. Oh, I remember. You get back, and then it turns out, and then they kill everybody in your hometown.
So you go to revenge. Yeah. You go to the Shinra headquarters to rescue your people, and then there's a motorcycle chase where you bust out of the city of Midgar. So the game sticks you in the city of Midgar for like 10 hours, and at the very end of your escape from you get caught by the cops and put in prison, and Sephiroth frees you. Sephiroth is a soldier, like a legendary warrior. From the Shinra, who Cloud, the hero of the game, used to like be comrades with in the army. And Sephiroth had disappeared several years ago, and now he's back for some reason. And he appears in the game like 10 hours in, and there's this scene of gore and carnage. There's like blood all over the walls and everything, and he's like killed all these people. And the game's tone suddenly gets even darker. And then you escape from Midgar, and the guys ask you, who was that guy? And you're like in a hotel room in a city outside Midgar. There's like a real great sense of scope to it. And Cloud starts to tell the story of how he was in the army and he went back to his hometown with this soldier Sephiroth, who was really tough. And Sephiroth like found some laboratory in a dungeon in a house and started researching his past, how he was created. Like, Sephiroth is like some sort of magically augmented person, and he freaked out, went psycho, killed all the people in the city or whatever, and then Cloud killed him, like in a sword fight, which none of your friends believe. And then so for the whole game, you're on the run from these Shinra troops, and Sephiroth keeps appearing and trying to kill Cloud, and then Sephiroth eventually kills Eris. While Eris is, like, praying to save...
Whoa. Spoilers.
That's the spoiler.
I'm pretty sure that screenshot of Sephiroth killing Eris has been featured on the front page of Kotaku, so we're good.
I am not going to say anything happened.
Plot spends a whole bunch of time building up the fact that Eris is, like, the savior. She's, like, the she-Jesus in this game, and she's, like, the love interest. But then you also have your childhood friend Tifa, who's, like... another love interest, right? So you have like a love triangle going on, and it's built up that Eris is going to save the world, and you visit all sorts of people, and there's like this tribe that lives on a mountain that believes Eris is the savior of the world, and she's praying to save the world because Sephiroth has gotten a hold of some magic crystal that will summon a meteor to destroy the whole earth, and Eris is praying to defeat the meteor, and then Sephiroth appears out of nowhere in this really ropey, plasticky action figure-y looking cutscene, and he stabs her in the back.
So it's like Archie Comics if Reggie ran a sword through Betty?
Yes. Yes. If Reggie had really long white hair and a sword that was 9 feet long.
And Moose had a gun for an arm.
Yeah, the gun for the arm.
Yeah. Ferret the Moose.
Which one is Jughead?
Jughead.
That's Kate Sith.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Sith or Yuffie is also a pretty Jugheadish character. So then, like, after Eris dies, Cloud gets mad, and he vows to kill Sephiroth, but Sephiroth has descended into some crater in the north of the planet. And then there's political drama for the rest of the game, where you're thrown in jail and you have to evade this evil army. And then there's like these bounty hunters who are chasing you. And the bounty hunters are the Turks.
Turks are badass.
Like 50 hours after you were kicked out of Midgar, you have to go back in.
Is Turk capitalized?
It's capitalized. But no, not all four, five letters, no. Ah. They're just Turks as though they're from Turkey. So you go back to Midgar and you go back to finally beat Shinra and finish the fight, and the world is in chaos because there's this meteor going to land, and you freak out, and then there's this awesome boss fight where the Turks are like, well, the world is going to end, and there's three of them and there's three of you, and they're like, do you want to fight? Like, if you want to settle this, let's fight right now at the end of the world. And you can choose no, and if you choose no, they go, all right, well, good luck, and they just walk away. And that's, that, to me, is where the game truly ends, because that's the end of Disc 2. And then after that, there's this cacophony of a final dungeon where you fight Sephiroth, and it's just this long, plodding dungeon where at the
God,
end...
God, I hate that dungeon. It's
so bad. And it's the beginning of bad Final Fantasy games, that dungeon. But we can get to that later, hopefully. But when you kill Sephiroth, it's just like you escape in an airship, and then you see Aeris's face hovering over the earth, and then a whole bunch of like magic snakes fly out of holes, and the meteor explodes in the sky, and then it says 500 years later, and nobody really understands what happened. 500 years later, there's wilderness and a bunch of happy animals.
Dog people.
Yeah, dogs running around.
Dog people.
Just kind of dog people just barking.
Yeah.
Weird. And then...
And you saved the planet from the... Well, Shinra was sucking it dry, too. Everybody was sucking it dry, and you saved it.
Yeah, you... and everyone was sucking it dry, and you blow it out at the end. You stop the sucking. That's what you do.
Great. Does that mean...
Now you know.
Now I know.
You have no questions at all.
Well, why did Sephiroth want the world to end?
Because his mom was a mutant energy force from within the Earth.
Genova. Wasn't Genova something that had fallen to Earth or something like an alien?
Yeah, I think Genova was like an alien and they cloned him from her. So that was like his mom. It was like an alien force that just wanted to destroy everything or something.
Some sort of alien master race or something that Shinra had like... killed and then cloned into Sephiroth and distorted its power so that it could be greatly destructive or something, and Sephiroth was all sad.
So Sephiroth wanted to destroy the Earth because he wanted his mom to be proud of him?
His mom
physically,
was...
yeah. He was like, well, she was like still alive, right? Because he stole her crazy corpse.
Yeah, he stole her corpse. You should really play it to get a better explanation.
So he's kind of running around with his mom's corpse being like, we're going to get it done, Mom. I'm going to blow up this planet, too.
His mom's corpse still has magic powers and can reanimate briefly to...
Wait, wasn't the idea that Aeris was also descended from the alien corpse? Like, they were both ancients?
Well, Aeris and Sephiroth are similar. They're both ancients, yeah. But Aeris...
Nope, just more... Oh, no, that was the whole thing, is that they had different interpretations of what was supposed to happen. Aeris was like, the ancients are supposed to lead everybody to the promised land. Sephiroth's like, the milk and honey is only for us humans suck.
Well, Sephiroth had been... he grew full of hatred when he discovered that he was only created as a destructive force, and he had zero confidence in the humans and decided to kill them. Meanwhile, Aeris was a lowly flower girl who grew up in the slums of the world's largest city and thought that people were good. It's some sort of real...
kind of Disney-like. Like, she could sing a song at that point.
I was about to say you could make a Broadway musical out of this.
Yeah, you mentioned that Cloud thought he killed Sephiroth in a sword fight?
Yes, so this is one of my favorite things about Final Fantasy VII, is there's that flashback scene that happens. So 10 hours into the game, you meet this antagonist, this freak of nature with white hair and a 9-foot-long sword who just appears out of nowhere, right? And then everybody's like, who the heck was that guy? Why did he know you?
Right. And up to this point, you're like, Cloud's just a dude who used to be in a gang and just hung out.
And he doesn't want to talk about his past. And then once you escape the city, which involves a motorcycle chase where you're controlling the motorcycle and it's an action game for 5 minutes, which is real. So you get out of the city and you're like, we have to escape to this town to the north. Let's get up there ASAP, right? And you get there and then you rent a hotel room and then he tells the story, right? But there are inconsistencies in his story that as you meet people who are involved in the story, and the story keeps coming back to that one fateful day where Sephiroth went crazy and burned down this city, right? So it keeps coming back to that story. And, I think that's like a really neat device. It's like a fiction device, whereas
unreliable narrator, my buddy.
Yeah, at the end of the day, the game is actually about something, whether it's literature or not. I don't want to. I can't say because it's not. but written like fiction. That's why I like it. Anyway, we should get.
I always felt like it was a really good manga. It's like, you know, okay, like this storyline is fluff, but at least I want to hear about these people.
You can read right through it. Anyway, yeah. to another question.
Okay. Well, I've been a little disingenuous up until now. I did play a little bit of Final Fantasy VII. I played right up to the point where you get to that train yard, a little past the cross-dressing brothel scene, and I stopped because I figured that was the best part of the game already.
You are not wrong.
I don't know.
Ian Art agrees with you.
I would say you are a little bit wrong, because I think the Shinra Tower all the way through the Cloud's Past flashback is the best part of the game.
Cloud wears a dress, Tim. What are you going to say something was better than that?
Yes. The whole Shinra Tower thing was really...
All right. Maybe.
What's the question, Jeff?
The question is, are there any little watershed moments like that I missed if I appreciated that bit?
I would say that whole flashback scene is really neat, because you're just playing a flashback and there's like no combat. And you're playing for like 2 hours just in...
There's combat, but it's like fake combat, which makes it even kind of cooler.
Where Sephiroth has 99 hit points and he's doing damage with his massive sword and he's killing...
You do like 20 damage to that thing and then he kills it in one damn hit.
Yeah, he has like... And he like heals you if you somehow manage to die. And
Wait, so Sephiroth is on your team during this flashback?
Yeah, man. Cloud. You guys used to be in Soldier together.
Yeah, they were Soldier military buddies together.
Oh, neat.
He had your back, but then he went nuts. And then actually he didn't have your back because your flashback was weird, but whatever.
Because Cloud is somewhat of a pathological liar, and he has these weird identity problems. And
Cloud thinks that he was the star of Final Fantasy VII Crisis Core.
Yeah, but really...
He actually wasn't.
Yeah, so it's really, really neat, because there's kind of a theme, like a really weird psychological theme. And again, watershed moments, it keeps coming back to that. And it's like, as an 18-year-old who had previously only played a couple other Final Fantasy games, it was like, and then, you know, Dragon Quest 1 and 4, it's like, this is like really neat storytelling for a video game. So, like, there's a lot of those. There's a part where you go on a date in the Gold Saucer. Do you remember that, Vito?
Yeah, that was fun.
You like get to choose which.
I liked the Golden Saucer. It was interesting.
Yeah, the Gold Saucer's neat.
Oh, wow.
It's like, are you looking it up? It's like a big casino where you get to play all of the mini games from the game.
Is that the first time Final Fantasy VII had a casino, or Final Fantasy in general?
No, well, Final Fantasy VI had a monster battle arena, the Colosseum.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of like the Colosseum in the in the Gold Saucer. But
so it's like a dating sim. Like there's a little bit that like you go on a date and like you have to determine if it's like a good date or a bad date, and you pick who to go with.
Well, like, but
you don't get to pick. You pick through your actions in the game.
Yeah, you get you pick
like five dialogue choices.
There's like a bunch of there's like five times where you pick a dialogue, and it's like you can either have so you're like staying in the Gold Saucer for some plot related reason, and then there's some guy or like maybe Tifa will go on the date with you, maybe Eris will go on the date, but if you manage to mess it up really bad, you can go on a date with Barrett, which is...
Somebody was telling me that was a rumor. Is that... I thought it was true, and then the other day somebody was like, no, that's not for real. You can go on a date with Barrett, right?
I'm gonna type date Barrett into Google, let's see.
I've seen a screenshot like that, so...
Yeah, that could be faked, though. I don't actually know. But yeah, like, the questions they'll ask is, like, you meet Eris for the first time, and she goes, so, do you have a girlfriend? And then your answer is either, like, yeah, I'm banging this chick, or, nah, what's up? And that affects the in-game, unseen, she's in love with you score. But don't fall in love with her, because she's just gonna die.
Yeah, Barrett, you definitely can date Barrett.
Do you get any action?
What a date it'll be. No, you don't get any action. Mostly he just complains the whole time.
You just sit around rides and the characters talk to each other is all that happens.
Yeah, he goes, it's like, oh, I can't believe Avalanche is gone now.
No action at all. If that's the question you're asking, if there's another watershed moment, no, there's no action, unfortunately. There wouldn't be action in a Square Soft game until Xenogears. there's a part of Xenogears on the eve before the end of the world. The main character and his love interest are lying in a bed together, and then the guy gets up and he's like totally nude.
Now, I am pretty sure you get action in that brothel.
I don't know if that counts or if.
Wait, in the final with Cloud?
Yeah.
No, there's no action.
What you mean, Cloud and those swinger people?
Yeah, those like swinger dudes. You like wake up and they're the dudes there.
Yeah, I guess maybe there's action there.
No, wait. It ends with like you get in bed and then you confront the guy.
No, wait. We're talking about
with the dudes in the hot tub.
To get the hot tub.
That's just a little friendly touching. That's not action.
Now that I think about it, there was action like right at the beginning of Final Fantasy IV. Cecil and Rosa definitely have intercourse the night before Cecil goes out to the Mist Village, because she comes up to his room.
I remember that.
And they're having an argument, which is, you know, video games. If that seems to be what fiction has taught us, that couples have arguments somehow before or after intercourse.
Before slaughtering like a village.
Yeah, and then also before killing a dragon, which murders a young girl or whatever it is.
Or is that what happened in Final Fantasy IV?
Kill the dragon, and it's a young girl's mom, and then. The package explodes and kills everybody. So Final Fantasy IV starts with an act of terrorism as well. That's a little interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I would say definitely in terms of set pieces, there's a whole bunch of neat stuff that happens in Final Fantasy VII. Nothing involving the cross-dressing. First of all, I don't think we should call it cross-dressing. I think we should just call it wearing a dress. The way we call it wearing a t-shirt is wearing a t-shirt. I mean,
depends on how – no, I mean you can get those like special – makeup.
If I wear a dress, I'll wear a dress. I'm not going to call it cross-dressing. I mean, come on.
Yeah, but what if you take the time to get like the special wig and the perfume and everything?
Well, no, I'm just talking about real life cross-dressing.
Right.
I'm talking. Anyway, let's move on to another question, Jaffe.
Okay. Does Final Fantasy VII do anything interesting gameplay-wise I should know about?
Love that materia, I tell you what.
I don't actually think it does anything interesting gameplay-wise, no.
I guess that's more a system-based thing.
It has...
Limit breaks? That was, like, a thing.
I don't know if limit breaks were a thing. Well, maybe... I guess they were. So you know what a limit break is, right, Jaffe?
Sure.
They have those in some of the other Final Fantasies, where when your character's about to die... Or
No, it's just like when you got hit a meter. A lot.
Yeah. I actually think that's dumb because it carries over to like another battle. I think Final Fantasy VIII's limit break system was better. Was that the closer you get to zero HP, the closer you get to a critical percentage of HP, the greater the chance, like it flips a coin to see if you get a limit break, so that if you stay in critical, you'll have a really great chance of having a limit break. So you just
I thought Crisis Core's limit breaks were the best, where a slot machine determines it entirely at random with no input from the player.
Sometimes the slot machine just like level up, you gained 5 levels.
God, that was the worst stupid game. I'm so bad that like Final Fantasy VII fans defend it. They're like, no, you don't get it.
And it had a really nice graphical presentation style, and it had good
kind of
voice acting, and the music was really good, and then the game was just a garbage bag shivved open in front of a large metal electric fan.
I just loved that the plot was like this major character was off to the side during several cutscenes, out beside the camera's range in the original Final Fantasy VII. He was just standing a little over here. This character you've never heard of before.
Too bad about that darn guy. But anyway, gameplay-wise, you have materia, which are little crystals that are like the magicites in Final Fantasy VI, like the espers,
yeah.
Right? But instead of equipping like two of them per character, you have weapons which have slots, right? And so you can have like a sword that has like 4 slots. You can put 4 materia in there. And whenever you fight, you get magic points which level your materia up. So say you have an ice materia, right? So you gain, it'll say that you need to gain 5 magic points to get it to learn the ice spell, but then you have to earn 500 magic points to get the ice 2 spell, and then gain 10,000 to get the ice 3 spell, right? So you've got to have it equipped to get those points at the end of the battle. And some weapons will give you double materia growth, right? So it's like, this weapon is weak in battle, but I get double materia growth with it. So as you can see, there is a lot of room, and you'll get an average of like 2 or 3 magic points per battle. So you have to grind a lot to level up your materia. I'm giving a very simplistic example, and those numbers are not exactly indicative of the actual game. But
well, the materia that augmented equipment, which you didn't see all that often, but like you could, if you put a poison materia and then whatever the attack materia was, it would make it so your sword did poison damage.
It sounds like a more complex version of how you learn skills in Final Fantasy Tactics.
Yeah, that is true. Is it
more complex or less complex?
More complex, I feel like materia was pretty easy. Each weapon in Final Fantasy Tactics intrinsically had a skill mapped to it, whereas I'm thinking with these materias, you put them in slots in the weapon.
I would say Final Fantasy VII's materia, it's incredibly easy to understand on a surface level, but it has depth. There's like a whole bunch of depth. And the game, especially when you get to the optional bosses, the game forces you to like break the system. So you have to get really, it's kind of like solving a little murder mystery, trying to figure out what exact combination of materia is necessary to kill this boss with a million hit points who erases two of your party members at the beginning of the battle at random, right? Well, not at random, but the two guys on the left and right. So the guy in the middle is the one who stays. But yeah, so the materia system has this kind of neat overlying Rubik's Cube-y quality to it, where when you take the materia off of somebody, you lose something. Whereas when you unequip a Magicite from somebody in Final Fantasy, if it's all the way leveled up,
you just have that skill.
Yeah, it's like you've got the skill, it's yours. But
Equipping materia would make people, made their physical stats go down.
Yeah. So
theoretically, if you were like, I really just want a guy to hit people, you wouldn't even give him any materia, but I don't think anybody played the game like that.
Some people did. You can level up, level up your ice materia on one guy and then give it to another guy, right?
Yeah.
And then that, like, if you learn ice 3 and then you give this materia to somebody else, they have ice 3 now. Whereas in Final Fantasy VI, if you unequip the Magicite, you still have the spells that you learned with it.
Right.
So it was kind of like you're passing them around. Whereas in Final Fantasy, they're kind of like, Final Fantasy VII, they're kind of meta characters. They're kind of like little characters in and of themselves. And as a system, it's actually really neat. And it's the kind of thing that Final Fantasy XIII and Final Fantasy X didn't do. Well, Final Fantasy X sort of did, but I won't get into that. But Final Fantasy XIII, for example, you just level everybody up, and it's like everybody can learn everything, and everybody's got equal opportunity to learn everything, and everybody gets the same number of points at the same time. There's no element of choice or planning to it. It's just keep plugging away at the system.
Yeah, I only played 13 too, but I don't get it. Like, it seems like I just eventually have every skill for every character, and it doesn't matter at all.
You just plug the points in. Oh, if you level a materia up all the way, this is very important, Jaffe. If you level it up all the way, it splits. It makes a copy of itself. So if you have like an ultra rare materia that has an ultra hard spell, yeah, you can level it up to get another materia. Am I making that up?
No, I remember that happening. Yeah, wouldn't it be like?
I haven't done that in my recent playthrough of the game. But yeah, you can see where they could have. They put this game online and gave it achievements or whatever. Man, they could have just monetized.
Split a materia. That's an achievement.
No. They could have just been like 25 cents to level.
Buy a materia. Level it up. I would see a store for materia. Like, you want a materia? Buy a fire materia. $1.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, everybody wants to design a new game that uses systems Final Fantasy and monetizes them, but then it's like when you're creating a game like that from the ground up, and I know from experience working in social mobile games, when you're creating a game from the ground up where it's like, yeah, 25 cents to level up this materia, you start creating really big sinkhole sized reasons for players to want to level their materias up, you know? It's like, yeah, boss is impossible without a leveled up materia. And then it's like, I think just shoehorning that into Final Fantasy as it is would work, because the world has proven that people will play the game without, you know, the option to pay to level up, right? I mean, 10 million copies sold. I mean, there you go.
But would anyone have done it that way if it shipped with that monetization strategy?
Well, they would have immediately seen it as evil. They would have been like, what is this? I pay money to level up? That's terrible. And then, but yeah, that would have been funny. It would have been an interesting thing, but obviously that infrastructure wasn't in place then. They probably should have thought it up. I remember when Gran Turismo 5 was announced as, like, they had, like, a free-to-play model set up, and it's like, you can pay money to buy cars, and, like, that just got rejected so fast that they were like, yeah, we were just kidding about that, guys. And then they just released it as a $60. I don't think it was free-to-play. I don't know what it was. They were talking about it being, like, a budget-priced game that you then bought your cars with real money. But the idea was so, like, lampooned on the internet at that.
I don't hate that idea. How many cars do I want to play as in the car game?
Yeah, I want Subaru and I want my Toyota Supra. You know, yeah. I want my WRXs. I want my Supra. Anyway, let's do another question. What do you think?
Okay. What makes these characters particularly memorable?
Oh man. Well, Cloud's got a big sword. Barrett's got
a gun on his gosh darn arm.
Red 13 is just a big panther.
A big panther.
I didn't like Red 13.
He's like a big panther who can speak human words.
So is he around 500 years later?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that was him in the cutscene, right?
Like, he's like an immortal being.
He's an immortal dog man.
Oh, neat.
He's actually a lion, but yeah, we're calling him a dog and a panther as a joke. But I think he's like some sort of ancient species of mystical lion creature.
Well, they give him a name like the Nakai or something. Maybe I'm crazy. I don't remember.
Why is he Red 13?
Because
it's just his code name from when they experimented on him.
Yeah, he was like an experiment, so they gave him like a code name.
Ah.
So, yeah.
I mean, people have always speculated. They're like, is there a Red 12? And we're like, we don't know. It's Japan. They just want to give everything a name.
I think Nanaki is his name.
Nanaki.
Nanaki.
Yeah, I thought that was the name of his race, but I guess that's his real name.
I'm going to type Nanaki into Google. Red 13, Final Fantasy. That's pretty funny.
So what else is memorable about the characters? I mean, there's a lot of girls. They're all kind of pretty.
There's the, as we explained, there's the fairy princess Miyazaki movie girl, kind of girl, Aerith.
And then there's the chick with just her bitties hanging out.
Tifa. She's got a big old pair of
bitties.
Boobies.
I mean, if you're going to be a terrorist, you might think that you would wear more than a tank top and suspenders, but I tell you what.
Kind of funny, she's wearing a tank top, suspenders, and, like, hot shorts.
I know.
No. You know? Like,
I wonder if it's, like, a thing where, like, you know, they get caught on the street. It's like, hey, have you seen terrorists that are around here? And it's like, no, I'm just a streetwalker. And they go, okay. And
then I remember her having boxing gloves. Did she have boxing gloves?
She has these little, like Sakura has in Street Fighter, the, like, fingerless gloves.
She's wearing, like, martial artist kind of gloves. But
a little metal pad.
So it's like when Square Enix.
Well, they were Squaresoft when the game came out, bro.
Sure were, so I guess I'm right. When they try to, like, capitalize on Final Fantasy VII, they just kind of, like, copy it over. Like, they treat it like a template. Like, Final Fantasy XIII's got a girl who's kind of tough and is like, I don't care about you guys. I'm just here to do my job.
God, what a bad character.
Yeah, lightning. Cloud lightning comes out of clouds, obviously.
Squall comes out of clouds.
Squall is a formation of clouds, yeah.
So is the protagonist of 15 going to be Rain? Or maybe Smog?
Have they not had a character named Rain yet?
They had a character named Rain. In Final Fantasy VIII, there was a guy named Rain, I think. Ah. Don't quote me on that. But, yeah, so they're just often named after weather. But, so, like, yeah, she's like a – Lightning is like a she-cloud, you know, but
– Well, she's not a she-cloud. She's a she what Squaresoft thinks Cloud was, but at Cloud actually wasn't.
Yeah, Cloud –
Cloud – like, Squaresoft or Square Enix has reinterpreted Cloud as – this jerk who doesn't say anything and just is constantly brooding because his girlfriend is dead.
Yeah, like,
which in the original game, I guess he was kind of fun. He had some, like, you know, witticisms.
He had a couple of moments, and you know how what was that?
Yeah. Do I like, know how what?
We were saying how Cloud. Okay, you know how like. All RPGs were stories about people with amnesia, people who had forgotten something. Cloud was a guy who hadn't forgotten, right? He just
remembered everything wrong.
He's just like, he has like psychological problems, right? And the story actually explores them instead of bonking him on the head and he's got his memories back and now I know where to go, guys. We have to go to the city in the north or whatever, right?
Final Fantasy VIII was my favorite for that, which has a cutscene where they go, hey, weren't we all in an orphanage together?
Why didn't we remember?
Like, literally every character at the same time goes, oh yeah, isn't the main villain of the game? She used to be in charge of the orphanage. And you're like, wow, this is a great plot twist you get.
Orphanage matron or something? And then they're like, why didn't we remember? It was probably because of the GF.
Yeah, it was probably because we spent too much time in this float in high school with our magic monsters.
They actually say it was probably because of the GF.
Guardian... Oh, did they say GF, not Guardian Force?
Say the GF. And I was like,
GF.
Like, those characters were just like, Tetsuya Nomura drew a character. He's like, yeah, here's a guy. He's just... character was like a part of the plot first, and a character.
The only one who heard like weird scraping a second ago.
Not as well. It was probably Jaffe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So like in Final Fantasy VII, they weren't like character designs. They were parts of a plot first, and then they did a character design. Like, okay, the main character is going to be like a cool looking guy, and then he's got to have a friend who's like big and muscular because his character's kind of big and muscular. Like, they wrote characters first. That's my impression. They wrote it like a piece of fiction.
For 8 or for 7?
For 7. And then for 8, it was like, Nomura, you're pretty cool at drawing clothes, right? Can you just draw us, like, 6 people wearing cool clothes and they're all around 8? Then it's like, there's Barrett is like 30-something, right? He's got a child. And then Sid is like 40. A wife, right? So there's people in this game who have had sex before, right?
Which is a thing that Final Fantasy games have not had.
They were
in recent years.
Were strikingly celibate after this game. So the characters are written as like kind of related to humans, and then the settings are like Final Fantasy 13 is like you're walking down a racetrack with like some giant blown glass sculptures and rhinoceros-sized ghost motorcycles kind of flying around to your left and right, and then there's just a road, whereas Final Fantasy VII is like, that looks kind of like a cafe, and then here's like a noodle shop you can go into, you know? It's not like people complained Final Fantasy XIII didn't have towns. It's not that they really wanted towns per se, they just wanted places that looked like
places.
They were lived in. And so that's how the environments in Final Fantasy VII are, right? They feel lived in. And the whole world feels lived in. And most importantly, the characters feel lived in.
I mean, I attribute a lot of that to the fact that the game had those, like, pre-rendered backgrounds, which I still think just had so much, like, life to them.
Yeah, charm.
Yeah, even
you would pack the frame with, like... Yeah, you would pack the frame with detail and then be like, well... nobody has to rotate this around, so I don't got to worry about where the camera's going to be. I can just put it right the hell here.
Those details do look pretty bad on a 70-inch LED HDTV.
Yeah, but back then I was like, oh man, this world is cool. I want to see what's in that pipe.
It's god darn incredible back then. So, in closing, the characters feel lived in. And
the environments as well.
And the environments as well. And in Final Fantasy 13, we've got a girl who's just like... the surface level trait of Cloud in that he's kind of a nonchalant jerk. And then there's literally a dark skinned, afro haired, man with a beard.
And a child.
Oh, so he has had sex before.
Yeah, so he has, but it doesn't count because he's also presented as kind of a goof. But, and he also, his weapon is firearms, which is like, 3 traits of Barrett from Final Fantasy VII just lifted right off. It's like if someone who is really attractive cosplayed as this ugly character from this, like this ugly drawing of this character from another game, like, right?
you're saying Saz from Final Fantasy XIII is a Barrett cosplayer.
He's like,
and an ugly Barrett cosplayer at that.
He's an attractive Barrett cosplayer.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
Model. cosplaying as Barrett. And then they're like, we don't even really need to, that character looks so good. We don't even really need to write him. You know? It's like, he's just going to remind people of Barrett. So that is the detailed answer. That's the straight dope is what that is.
Straight dope. Let's move on.
Move on to your next discussion point. This is working fairly well for an inaugural podcast.
Yeah. Final Fantasy VII sure spawned more sequels and spin-offs than any other Final Fantasy game. Why do you think that is?
Because they were all warranted as necessary extensions of this fantastic plot.
Because Final Fantasy VII was the most popular Final Fantasy, because it was the first game with cutscenes, and the cutscenes were on goddarn national television. They were on Pepsi cans. You know, they had like the cutscenes were on Pepsi cans, but the 3D models, the characters, the CG was like marketed on Pepsi cans and Mountain Dew cases, and
people bought toys with characters from this game.
It was the first game in there for that game with a whole bunch of jaw-dropping, eye-popping, mind-blowing, hat-destroying CG, you know? Like, CG that would ruin your hat because it would just fine.
I had a lot of hats ruined by that game, I tell you what.
Yeah, so it's like, if you were a slightly seasoned gamer, if you were a little bit salted or a little bit peppered at the point that Final Fantasy VII came out, if you'd played Super Mario Brothers, and then, you know, if you'd been around the block maybe one and a half times when Final Fantasy VII came out, it was such a mind blower just to see what video games had become. And you only get a chance to really be surprised like that in your life once or twice. I'm spoiling that for you guys as a 33-year-old. You only get a chance to really, really be surprised by stuff like that once or twice, right? And for a lot of people, Final Fantasy VII was that. Like, there were people whose it was the first game they loved, right? And there were people who it was their first big, amazing surprise. So it just, in other words, it was in the right place at the right time, and it became a franchise. Like, it's like, we have to franchise this. And it's like, they didn't realize that they needed to franchise it until a couple of years later. They'd already.
Well, that was after they had lost. When did they start franchising it? Wasn't it after they had all the Spirits Within?
It was, so they made the Spirits Within, which was a movie set in New York City, which was
super future.
In the super future. Final Fantasy VII, actually, a little trivia here, was supposed to be set in New York City, and it was more or less the Spirits Within's plot. I don't know if you guys knew that.
And then he still had the script lying around. He's like, probably make a great movie to put us out of business.
Twisted Right. You know what? I'm gonna tell you to shut up, because that movie was pretty good. It's actually pretty good. It's the character's mouth movements are a little bit weird, but so
Final Steve Fantasy Buscemi was in that movie. He won an award for it.
He won an award for it.
Well, he won an award for his work of that year, of which Final Fantasy was included.
Final Fantasy, Roger Ebert gave it like 3.5 stars, I think, which I don't know if it deserves that, but maybe 3 stars. So, Dirge of Cerberus.
Roger Ebert gave Blue Velvet like a 1 star.
Yeah, he took it back later, sort of. I just watched the Roger Ebert Blue Velvet review the other day on YouTube, but I digress. 2006 is when Dirge of Cerberus came out. Dirge of Cerberus was the third-person shooter about Vincent, because people just wanted that, obviously.
We haven't discussed Vincent at all.
Vincent is the...
Vincent is your fan fiction character.
He looks cool. He's wearing a cape that is fastened with a series of buckles. It's like a red asymmetrical cape. And he's got a big bandana and huge black hair.
He's like a vampire,
there's
right?
There's nothing important about him in the plot at all. So you speculate, he's like, man, he's so cool.
He's like a vampire, yeah, because he was experimented on and he's, like, augmented. He's an optional character. Like, you don't have to actually get him.
He's actually hard to get. I had to, like, look up how to get him when I was a kid because I couldn't figure it out.
You got to go back to a town that you...
And investigate a crypt that for no one ever told you to investigate for any reason.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you go in there, and then there he is. He pops out, and he's your bro. And then he even has a little cutscene that explains his past.
That's later. Nice.
Yeah, so that's kind of neat. He's kind of like a Frankenstein vampire character. So he looks cool, and he was people's favorite character to draw fan art of and write fan fictions about because of his tragic story. He also has had intercourse before. right? So, like...
Oh, yeah, he had a wife.
He's probably having intercourse right now.
Yeah, somewhere on this... in some other spiritual plane, he's probably having himself a GOT, a good old time. So, he is a cool guy, and they just decided to make a game where he's got guns, and it's like an unofficial... And he's just shooting dudes up. It's like
the shooting. The way you describe it, really is just that.
Yeah.
So they decided to make a game where he has guns.
It's like there's like a cut scene, and it's like, Vincent, what are you doing here? I'll kill you.
Is that the first video game appearance of Gackt? I believe it is.
Gackt plays the main bad guy, right? Like
Superstar Gackt.
Like he's like he voices the guy, and he did a song for the game, and it's like it's totally a case of Japan's it's I guess a case of what we would call executive producers at work. You know, it's like this is what an executive producer does, is they put together a product.
Like, now, they started doing this before or after Kingdom Hearts?
Oh, this was after Kingdom Hearts. This was.
I'd like to separate my Square Enix into post Kingdom Hearts, Kingdom Hearts, post Kingdom Hearts, because after Kingdom Hearts came out, they realized, hey, Disney makes a lot of money selling toys, everything you make could probably be turned into toys if we try hard enough.
Weird, scary thing about Kingdom Hearts is that it didn't really make its money because of the Disney characters so much as it made its money because. There were a lot of people who just wanted to see Final Fantasy VII characters in another game, and I know that sounds ridiculous.
Having
but...
not played Final Fantasy VII, I can say both the fights with Sephiroth in the Kingdom Hearts series were pretty fun.
Yeah, they lavished a lot of attention and production value on there. But so Dirge of Cerberus is a bad shooting game made by people who had never played a shooting game, much less made one. But it has these – it's got kind of a neat graphics engine in it. It has some neat 3D. They made some other games. They made this Crisis Core game when Square Enix decided to put the cigar down and help Sony sell the PlayStation Portable. They're like, yeah, we'll put a Final Fantasy VII related game on there. And then the sales just blew through the roof. The fans go nuts whenever this game gets re-referenced because of what I said about it being a lot of people's first video game love. Would you guys agree with that?
Sure.
I mean, it was like a lot of people's first mind-blowing, oh my god, look at this. This game is cool. And then it's the nostalgia factor. But
now it's kind of become like, what's that rapper? You know, it's like your sophomore effort. I mean, I guess they had made a couple games before, but like Final Fantasy VII was like the one where they're like, we're going to be on top forever, you know, pour the champagne, and then they just can't redo it. They don't know what made it magic.
Well, here's my theory. Final Fantasy VII was right place, right time, re-CG, right? The CG was new. As I put it to someone else today, it was a game that caught up the console gamers with all the advances that had happened in PC. Like, Final Fantasy VII came out around the time that Quake 2 was already out, you know? And so there's just a lot of stuff that console gamers hadn't seen, such as CG and, you know, this amazing audio quality and all these 3D pre-rendered backgrounds and all that. So people were really fascinated by it. It was right place, right time. And that was all that was different. At its heart, Final Fantasy VII was as good as Final Fantasy VI on paper, right? Without all the CG bells and whistles, it could have been a 2D game, but they added that CG to it, and it sold. And it sold because of right place at right time. But then when, from a business perspective, Square Enix looks at it and they go, well, all that's really different about this game is we added a bunch of CG. So graphics are what really matters. And it was like a mathematical proof to these business school guys, right?
Right.
How does the idea of a 2D Final Fantasy VII really appeal to me?
It appeals to me so much. I want a Final Fantasy. Is that your next discussion?
No, it's not.
I would love Final Fantasy VII if it looked just like Final Fantasy VI, and I would play the heck out of it on my Vita.
Yeah.
I think it's a hilarious way for Square to
remake it.
They say that they won't remake. Like, they're official.
They won't make an HD
remake. No, let's get into that later. That's one of my later questions.
OK. Okay, well, I'm waiting for that one. Let's get on. Let's use that as a perfect opportunity to go to the next question.
How would you compare? Oh, this is a good segue. How would you compare Final Fantasy VII to earlier games in the series, like 4 and 6?
I would say that at its heart, it's the same screwball weirdo storytelling from 4 and 6. It's as Vito said earlier, it's like a manga, you know, and it's
just like a manga. You got Turks and soldiers and all these things that sound cool.
And you hear old school game developers say this all the time, that constraints were what made old games cool. Like Super Mario Brothers music sounds so good because they had to work with that NES sound chip. The story in Final Fantasy 4 and 6 is so good because they had to work with those quote unquote limited graphics, right? So Final Fantasy 7 had a story that was prepared for the old method of not having wowing graphics. So it's like, and I'm sure that I will lose a little bit of my old school gamer street cred to say this, but it's as good as Final Fantasy 4 and 6.
I mean, you mentioned,
I think it's the better. I think it's the best one.
Yeah, why do you think it's the best one? Like, I'm not just...
Nothing, there's nothing bad about Final Fantasy 7. It's just because, like, I don't know, man. That game is just, there's so much that I want to know about this universe. It's stupid because it's a universe that it's the same as every other, like I said, it's like a manga. It's the same as every other universe where there's a bunch of factions, and they're all pissed about something, and the planet's in trouble, and all of them have troubled past or whatever. But for some reason, I want to know about all of it, and it gets there. It tells it well.
You mentioned The characters are basically terrorists in Final Fantasy VII. You're also basically terrorists in Final Fantasy VI. You're fighting against the Empire. You're the rebels.
Right.
It's that Star Wars-ism. It's Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, it's so Star Wars.
More than Final Fantasy VI is fantastically imaginative Star Wars fan fiction. I think even more, like, on an even better level.
I'd agree.
Wegs and Biggs and Wedge are there from the very beginning in Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah. They're also beginning in Final Fantasy, die at the beginning of Final Fantasy VI. So,
wow, do they?
They actually add a third Biggs and Wedge. Her name is Jessie. They have a third. They have, like, Biggs, Wedge, and Jessie, so it's three people.
And you get a crush on Jessie right away, and then she fucking dies.
That's very early, yeah. So,
fantastic.
Like, yeah, so that's another thing they do, is there's people die in Final Fantasy VII. Like,
so if Final Fantasy VII is like Star Wars, who's Han Solo?
Barret is Han Solo. And Cloud is a little bit of Han Solo. Cloud is part Han Solo.
And part Luke.
Yeah.
He's kind of like the main character from Spaceballs.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And then Han Solo, Barret is a little bit Han Solo-ish.
A little Chewbacca-ish.
And a little bit Chewbacca-ish, because he's tough, rough, and he doesn't take no guff.
Yeah.
So, finally, I would say compared to Final Fantasy VI, VII actually has a couple of, I discussed earlier, these complex, but not really complex, but very fiction-like, very, very writerly story mechanics, where it keeps revisiting this this one fateful day. It has multiple flashbacks to one day showing you different angles of it, right? This kind of Rashomon, I wouldn't say it's Rashomon-esque, because it's one character remembering different things or admitting that he lied about something, or another character going, you know, I was there too, by the way, and that...
I don't remember that.
I'm sorry, I wanted to mention this earlier, but I also wanted to see if you believed yourself. When Tifa says that, that's kind of neat. That's a neat moment. She's like, I wanted to call you out on that, but I also was kind of concerned, and I wanted to know if you really believed yourself, and I've determined that you do, so I'm going to say this, right? Like, there's a lot...
And mid-flashback, you can start looking for Tifa's underwear.
Yes. So you
got... That's Metal Gear Solid, isn't it? Where you're looking for underwear during flashbacks?
Exactly. Wait, or maybe we're all confused.
Well, there is a part where she has orthopedic something up in her closet.
Yeah, she has a whole bunch of stuff. And in Final Fantasy IV, there's like a character, Rydia, who gets like sucked into the core of the earth where time flows more quickly. So the first time you meet her, she's like 6 years old, right? She's the daughter of the dragon that you kill. Mm-hmm. And the time you meet her, she's all grown up. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty cool, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of little touches like that, but nothing so overtly like 1980s Japanese cartoonish you know? And then there's themes in Final Fantasy VI, like magic being reborn, and there's this character of Terra, but Terra's kind of interesting because she's very subtly written, but there's the Eris character, they just make her all, they split Tifa into, or they split Terra into two people in Final Fantasy VII. They've got Eris and Tifa.
The way you describe Tifa, I would compare her more to Celeste, maybe.
Yeah, but she's... The thing about Tifa is she's just an ordinary girl. You know? She doesn't have any sort of magic powers or anything. And she's Cloud's... she grew up with Cloud in the same town. They were kids together.
Ah.
Right? And, like, they have, like, this history, and she's been in love with him forever. And they never talk about it through the whole game, which is really neat. And it's just kind of there. And there's and then once Eris dies, she just like kind of completely backs off.
Like, I mean, I'm sure this was done on purpose, but this all seems very Scott Pilgrimish to me.
Oh man, I wonder what our friend Brian Lee O'Malley would have to say about that. But
girlfriend didn't die in Scott Pilgrim, luckily.
No, but with, like, the flashbacks and the not talking about past
relationships. Misremembering
everything? Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Bro has played the game.
Bro.
I've got kind of a good hunch that he's played through this, the whole...
Good old B-Lom.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of neat stuff. So the thing is, Final Fantasy VII was written from the ground up as a story. It's like, we're going to tell a story with this game, because that's what we're doing in these goddarn games. Right? That's my impression of it. And that's what the old Final Fantasies were like, and that's why people liked them as well. And it happens to have graphics.
I played Final Fantasy 13 too. I didn't play 13. Don't ask me why, but there's no story there.
I think that's a good segue into my next question.
Which is,
how would you compare Final Fantasy 7 to later games in the series, like 10 and 12?
It used to be that, like, when you had a story, you kind of had to tell it in a way that made sense, and the characters had to react differently to things that were happening. And now I play these Squaresoft games, and it seems like every cutscene is a variation of the cutscene I just watched with, like, slightly new information. So I play Final Fantasy 13 too, and every cutscene is, man, I don't know if we're going to find my sister. And then one of the characters goes, like, we're definitely going to find your sister. And you go, yeah, we'll probably find her. And then you go and keep doing that. Nothing changes.
My favorite example is Final Fantasy 13. All of the quote-unquote dungeons. They're not even dungeons. They're not even supposed to be dungeons. They're just levels, right? They're just corridors that sometimes kind of bend around, and there's beautiful scenery. The graphics are fantastic. They're, like, undisputably fantastic. And then during the battles, there's just huge numerals flying out of monsters as you hit them, because that's what they've decided we want, is delicious huge numerals, huge shining gold numerals, right? So you're walking down this racetrack of Earth with, like, you're like, there's cliffs on either side and there's oceans in the distance, and your characters are like, ah. And so, like, their idle chatter is, we've got to keep going. Yeah, let's hurry, guys. Oh, we got to get there. Oh, man, I hope we make it. And it's like nothing is specific to where they are. Right? It's like admitted in a goddarn press release, a guy who should not be allowed to talk anymore is like, yeah, we made more environments for Final Fantasy 13 than we knew what to do with. We could make a whole other game. Final Fantasy 13 was that whole other game. It's like stuff that they just ended up not able to put into the game. It's just it's art overload. Going back to what I said earlier, they said, well, all we really changed were the graphics, so graphics must be the selling point. And art overload. Square Enix is a company just, like, I think Naughty Dog is 75% game designers. I think that's a fact. Don't quote me on that. Check it, Wikipedia, if you want. But Naughty Dog is 75% game designers. I think Square Enix is probably 75% artists. Not saying that that's wrong or anything, but...
But it's wrong.
But it's not right.
It's not wrong.
Yeah, so Final Fantasy VII was like, we've got this plot, and we've got this Hironobu Sakaguchi guy producing it and kind of guiding the plot direction of it, and they had confidence in it, right? Whereas
Final Fantasy,
it's like none of the environments you're in are connected to the story, and they obviously recorded all of this voice acting before they knew where it was going to go, right? And so that's why, as Vito said, the cutscenes are all, we gotta find my sister, you know? And it's like, that's what the idle chatter is in Final Fantasy 13. They're like, they're dividing the game up to, we're on the run from the Empire, we're on the run from the bad guys, right? And then major plot point, we're not on the run anymore, right? So it's like, okay, let's record a whole bunch of incidental character chit-chat that's pre, that's before the point where we're not on the run anymore. Let's go. And then they just write up a couple pages and then that's it. Whereas Final Fantasy VII was like, this happens, this happens. They probably had a storyboard with like 20 major plot points on it. And they go, okay, this is our game. Aeris is going to die. That's the end of Disc 1. Then you go snowboarding. That's the beginning of Disc 2, which I thought was a little bit of a weird jump. You go from... MG Cryface.
Wait, snowboarding? You never mentioned snowboarding before this point.
There's a snowboarding minigame.
It's very important to the plot.
Yeah, like you have to escape from... So you like have a funeral for Aeris, and then it's like soldiers show up, and you're like, uh-oh.
And then her corpse gets away from you and starts sliding down a mountain.
No, it falls into the... no, that's...
You gotta chase it on your, oh my on your God. Snowboard.
Misleading you. It's you let her body into some water, and then she sinks into the water. Which is where she then becomes part of the planet and saves the world at the end of the game. But you then, like, the military shows up and they're chasing you, and you get on some snowboards and snowboard down a mountain or something.
Like SSX or the opening level of Sonic Adventure 2?
Feels kind of like if the programmers who made Cool Borders had people like dogs under their desk biting their testicles.
Well, yeah, now this is an action button podcast.
So that's what it feels like, more or less.
Also, I think it's really important to look at the distinction between 7 and 8. Because 7 really felt like this game where they didn't know what they were really doing. The PlayStation was like a new thing. Originally, they didn't even know they were going to do it for the PlayStation. They were doing N64 nonsense. And they just kind of threw it together, but it had this quality where it felt very honest, where they're like, let's make this game. Let's just get it done. Yeah. And then you look at, like, 8, which is like, oh, we know how to make games. You know, we made a ton of money on the last one. And 8? It's just this overproduced piece of garbage. It makes no sense.
It was, for the love of God, make a game now, for the love of God.
Yeah, like, we need the money. We want to get 2 more of these out by the console's lifespan. Like, what's the first idea that comes to your head? Floating teenager high schools. Do it! Just fucking do it.
Hironobu Sakaguchi had nothing to do with the plot of that. And you know what the big selling point of 8 was?
Like, what?
From a business perspective, the characters are all normal proportions. They're tall on the main field, and you see all of your party members following you around. So it's like, your characters are like normal human proportions, and they're very well dressed. And there's fantastic opening cutscenes.
So they were all Vincent Valentine.
I loved that opening cutscene.
Scene was great.
That game also tried to do like weird, tricky memory stuff where it's like, maybe you're this guy that you keep having flashbacks about, but then you're not, or you were.
Yeah.
I don't remember who Laguna was or why.
Well, that was an interesting enough plot device, but anyway.
Who was he? I just want a reminder. Does anyone remember? Yeah.
He was in love with a woman, and then they got separated because of some war. And then he got married later and had a child who was you, and then his woman got married later and had a child who was Rinoa, your love interest.
Oh.
It's like your genes are reunited. Wow. So it's really subtle about that, though. I've just spoiled the best part of the plot for you, so you don't have to play the game now.
It'll be okay, I think.
That sounds a little bit like Watchmen.
So, like, try to remember that in Final Fantasy, after Final Fantasy VIII, Square Enix announced 9, 10, and 11 on the same day.
Oh, wow.
9 was a Disney-looking Final Fantasy, which a lot of people say is the best in the series, but I'm not...
They're wrong.
I'm not. Maybe we can do a separate podcast on that someday. But 10 is kind of poised as, like, an actual kind of anime series. It had voice acting. It was given... It was really imaginative, and it was really focused. It was kind of like a Hayao Miyazaki Final Fantasy almost, right? but yeah. Sports in it somehow.
I played that minigame more than I played the actual game.
A lot of people did. And then Final Fantasy XI was an MMO.
10 is like if Miyazaki made a volleyball game.
Exactly. If Miyazaki made a something about volleyball. But so they announced those three at the same time, and they were like, they're like, they went from being this kind of plucky group of dudes who made games that like hip slash nerdy people loved to be a giant money making machine, and it's like, let's start getting these out. And 8 was just huge and thoughtless but stuffed with stuff. A perfect example is 7 had this wonderful music. Like, just throughout the whole game, the music was huge and atmospheric.
Oh, sure. Right?
It's just great. Like, get the soundtrack. It's great. The battle theme is still one of the best things I've ever heard, especially with these awesome audiophile Astro A40 headphones I'm wearing right now. That boss battle theme is just amazing.
Yeah, I listened to that, and I've, like, almost never played Final Fantasy VII.
It's like audiophile quality, right? And then all the atmospheric ambient music is fantastic. And then 8 has, like, a couple of pop songs. Like, by pop songs, I mean, like, that opening CG cutscene that Vito loves so much has this really great 3.5-minute song, you know? And it's, like, it's got this really neat 3.5-minute soundtrack. So it's, like, that's cool. And then there's a couple more of those throughout the game, and it's, like, and that sort of thing applies on just the whole scale of the production. And that is Final Fantasy, post-Fantasy VII.
If I wanted to go back and play Final Fantasy VII now, would it feel too dated to be playable?
No, it plays like any RPG you ever played in your life.
Yeah, except something I wrote about in an article for Kotaku that's going to get me a lot of hatred tomorrow. Which is
probably how you're listening to this right now.
It's probably how you found us. So there's what am I going to say? How do I say this? It's kind of hard to move around. Your character, like, there's a run button where you press the run button and, like, you hold the X button and then you press left or right. And it's done with a D-pad, but it's like pseudo 3D space. Whereas in Final Fantasy 1 through 6, you're just moving up, down, left, right. You know, you're not moving diagonals or anything. So it's like sometimes your guy just kind of lashes out in one direction, and it feels kind of weird. And the backgrounds that Vito and myself earlier described as being awesome and having lots of charisma and character, sometimes it's kind of hard to tell where your guy is because it's zoomed out, like, really far, and your guy's, like, really tiny. And you have to press the select button to, like, turn on an arrow. Like, they actually have, like, these guide arrows to show
where
the exits are, because it's like an interactive postcard collection sort of setup.
I was mad the first time I found out about the guide arrows you could turn on. Because then I was like, oh, before it seemed like I was discovering all these, like, secrets on my own, these little, like, hidden rooms. And now it's just like, you can go this way.
Yeah, BT-dub, if you don't know where to go, you gotta... They apparently added that because playtesters didn't...
have any idea what was going on.
Yeah. And, I mean, I'm kind of curious, Jaffe, to be like, what would someone think who's never actually played it? Would they... Someone who's played cool games. You played Gears of War, haven't you?
Yeah, I played Gears of War, but I never got into it.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, Gears of War is just a raw, off-the-top-of-my-head example, but it's like, that's a really modern game with modern graphics, and, you know, it's kind of built off of...
I mean, I think if you only grew up playing modern games, you're not going to want to play Final Fantasy VII. It's like...
But
the whole point is that, like, RPGs existed back before every game had numbers and plot and, like, character development through skill building. Mm-hmm. So now you can just play action games, and they have all the stuff you wanted out of an RPG. It's really like an obsolete genre, except for the whole Skyrim-like thing.
Yeah, which I think Skyrim has a lot of – it's got a lot of obsolescence kind of flowing.
Yeah.
Final Fantasy VII better than Skyrim?
I would say, yeah.
Yeah, of course. Skyrim,
I would rather
whatever.
Play Final Fantasy VII again than play Skyrim. Evidence, tried to play Skyrim last year, played about 20 hours, didn't play it much more. And then I just played Final Fantasy VII for about 35 hours in the last.
I mean, I only got drunk and played it at a red carpet event, but that was enough.
Skyrim.
I have video somewhere of a very drunk woman trying to show me how to kill cat monsters.
Oh, that's kind of cool. But I feel like... So everybody wants a modern remake of Final Fantasy VII. It's like, What would they, I mean, I don't think it even has to be an RPG, to be perfectly honest. Like,
yeah, why hasn't Square done a Final Fantasy VII remake?
I don't know, because it would philosophically break them. Because, like, it's just them acknowledging...
Well, it would be embarrassing. It's hilarious. If they did that, it would be like, yeah, we don't know how to make anything better.
They're like, look at the tens of millions of dollars we spent on Final Fantasy XIII. Yeah, I guess the game sucks. Sorry, guys. We're just going to make a Final Fantasy VII that looks like that.
But they've remade all the other Final Fantasy games up till VII. Well, but, not VI.
Yeah, but those are, like, ancient and nobody played them.
And what the people want, Jaffe, is they want... a goddarn triple A modern flagship quality Final Fantasy VII remake. They want it to look just like Advent Children, the movie. You know, they want it to look like that.
They want to cry like Twilight Princess made them cry.
Yes, like they cried at...
They want to cry like Grave of the Fireflies, Miyazaki, man.
I think he's referring to the incident wherein several video game bloggers stood up, shrieked and cried when Nintendo debuted Zelda Twilight Princess at a press conference because they'd been so disappointed by Wind Waker's cartoony aesthetic.
I hate video games.
Jaffe?
Yes, this is exactly what I was referencing.
Yeah. They cried?
Yeah, there were some people crying.
This was, shut up.
Because all they ever wanted was a Zelda with realistic graphics.
On video game forums, like, oh my god, I was literally in tears. Like, I mean, like, a couple people. At that press conference, and I heard the shrieks, and it was terrifying.
If I'm ever in control of the Zelda franchise, he's going to ride trains until the end of time. All train ride, all Spirit Track spinoffs. That's the Zelda canon.
That's actually a great segue to my final question.
So bad. Wait. So give us like another minute here. I just wanted to say, because we were talking about this earlier, I want a Final Fantasy VII remake that just looks like Final Fantasy VI, man.
Sure.
I just want it redone with sprite art, and I want it like on my iPad.
I want Final Fantasy VII that looks like Earthbound.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if it looked like Final Fantasy VI, that would be a little bit more consistent.
I don't want any more Final Fantasy VII. I already played Final Fantasy VII.
I want Final Fantasy VI redone with really sharp, shiny pixel art.
That's fun.
I don't want any remakes. Who wants it? Why?
Because
I don't want to play the same game again.
What I'm saying is I want a game of Final Fantasy VI's quality done for the iPad by Square.
You should play Chaos Rings.
Oh, yeah. Here's what I'm going to say.
Oh, God. What? No.
Yeah.
I love
Chaos Rings.
Why? You just run around and... All right.
Throw rings at people?
It's like Sonic.
Sonic the Hedgehog, Chaos Emeralds?
No, it's nothing like that.
It's got chaos and rings. It is exactly the same.
You know, this feels like my last opportunity to say this. Something I keep trying to remember to say, but Lost Odyssey, man. You know?
Never played it.
You liked Final Fantasy VII and Final Fantasy VI. And 10, and you wish there was a remake, and you haven't played Lost Odyssey, just, it's like $5 at GameStop.
It's $10 at Funko Land.
Like, not even 10, yeah, $10 at Funko Land, but only $5 at GameStop. So,
$2.50
from now on, we just use Funko Land whenever we refer to your local game retailer.
Heck no, I love Funko Land.
Can't we say Babbage's?
Babbage's.
No.
Anyway, do you want to get on to the next one?
Yes, this is the final question.
Topic. What do we got?
Back in 1998, I had to choose between a Nintendo 64 and a PlayStation, and as with so many others my age, that choice came down to Ocarina of Time or Final Fantasy VII. I went with Zelda. Did I make the right choice?
Absolutely not.
Man, holy. This is a very, very well thought out question.
I'm very glad that, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but a lot of people are coming around and realizing that Ocarina of Time is not the golden shining city of God, alright? It's a thing that has kind of cool dungeons.
Yes.
That's it.
Kind of blew its load. Like it's the graphics just,
The
horizons were like messed up. Like, stuff looked like it was, like, you're walking around Hyrule Field, the mountains looked like they were like 3 feet away from you. It was like really I'm not going to get into those details because I'll sound like a psychopath. But so when you say you had to choose between Final Fantasy and Zelda, was Final Fantasy already out at that time?
Yes.
So you were like, I want to play this. Kids at school were talking about it, right?
Kids at school were talking about Final Fantasy VII. Kids at school were talking about Ocarina of Time.
And you were 10 years old?
Yeah, 10.
So it's like, at that point, you'd probably seen and picked up a controller and played Super Mario 64.
Yes.
So that was like, I'm not going to try to spin this into any mean insinuations, but did you play Super Mario 64 before you played any other Mario games?
No. The first game I had was Super Mario Land.
Okay, and how old were you when you played that?
I was like 6.
Oh, hey, that's a pretty good age. I was about 7 when I first played Mario, like Super Mario 1.
Yeah, I would play Super Mario Bros. And Super Mario World around that age at a friend's house.
So you were able to see the advent of 3D as a semi-self-aware adolescent.
Yes. It blew my mind how much more amazing just the field in Super Mario 64 was than going through a level in Super Mario Land.
I remember going home crying because my friend had rented a Japanese Nintendo 64 and the older kids would not let me play it.
Oh, that's so sad. I first experienced Super Mario Brothers with my neighbor. He was rich. And, they were playing it.
Yeah, I totally understood.
That's the story. Yeah.
I totally understood why people would skip school to play Super Mario 64 at the demo kiosks.
Yeah, that game was big. And like, I was a teenager. I had a job at Target, so I managed to buy a Nintendo 64 like 3 days before they came out, right? Because we had them in the back room. Like, I'm gonna buy one of these, and I got it. And I bought Mario and I bought Pilot Wings, and I went nuts on it. You know, like I went crazy, and that was like a big thing to me. And so what I'm going to say here is, so you were a child, you were 10 years old, and it's like, do I want Final Fantasy or do I want Zelda? And you'd already experienced the joy of 3D Super Mario. Super Mario obviously felt so much better than something like Tomb Raider. I don't know if you'd played Tomb Raider.
But no, I haven't played Tomb Raider.
Just
the Extreme or whatever. Remember that biking game that was in every PlayStation kiosk for the first 2 years?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Not counting, like, arcade racing games, I guess Super Mario 64 was my first experience with 3D.
All right. So it was – and it was a really good one. And then you were, like – you could see Zelda before it came out, and you're, like, kind of – you're aware of it, and you kind of sense that it's going to be a similar experience, which it was, right? It was a 3D action adventure in this beautiful feeling world.
I believe Ocarina of Time was actually built on 64's, Super Mario 64's engine.
It sure is. It's a little bit more complicated than that. It was originally a game with pre-rendered backgrounds, like Final Fantasy VII. Oh. And as you can see in the Hyrule town, like the Temple of Time in the background.
Yeah.
That's a background. So there's a whole lot of history there that I won't bother getting into. But you knew what you were getting into was that it was a 3D game with this tactile feel and this world you can feel and blocks you push and stairs you climb and stuff, right? So as a 10-year-old, I would say you definitely made the right choice. However, if you had been my age, I definitely – Final Fantasy VII blew my mind. I played it straight through when it came out. Whereas, you know, time, I guess I was more interested in Ocarina of Time in one playthrough. I threw the first 3 dungeons, and then it was like, well, there's this girl I like, so I'm going to go hang out with her. And it was like – Final Fantasy VII, I was like, man, you know, there's this girl I like, but this game is pretty cool, so I'm going to not hang out where the girl is, and I'm going to play this game.
So if you're in the 18 to 24 demo and you're listening to this podcast and you picked a Nintendo 64, you made the right choice?
I would say yes. Like, Zelda was definitely a playground, and it was experiential, and it was a learning experience, and Final Fantasy VII was more of a – it was a story. It was a narrative. It was a soap opera.
I'm going to say that – how old were you, Jaffe?
I was 10.
You're saying you were 12, 10?
Yeah.
No better time to start growing up. Put aside your childish toys. Zelda? Final Fantasy was – it was – you know, then you'd belong to the crowd that knew – I don't know. It just felt something. You felt something playing that game. Well, I did.
Like I said, Link's at the very top of the podcast, Link's Awakening was the first game to really blow my mind, and I wanted that again.
It's a fantastic game. That ain't Ocarina of Time. Ocarina of Time won't make you feel anything. What do you feel in that game? Nothing.
There is
you're a little Link. You're a little fairy boy on a magic adventure. It's pointless.
It had scale. The levels were really big. And stuff was big, and you could feel it. You could see a mountain getting closer to you as you walk at it. Final Fantasy VII, you know, it had CG and all that, but I think Zelda...
It had like a city, man. That was a big city living. Put aside your school books and your childish dreams.
Was a little bit more impactful, like, for a younger person, I would say.
Either way, it's a worse game.
I'd rather replay Final Fantasy VII. Evidence, I just did replay Final Fantasy VII. Meanwhile, when I had the opportunity to play Ocarina of Time on a 3DS, I didn't play it, so...
I bought it on a 3DS thinking, like, maybe I've been wrong all these years. Maybe it was actually good.
You know,
pro tip, it was not.
Majora's Mask.
Majora's Mask is good.
Majora's Mask is the hotness.
Final thoughts on Final Fantasy VII.
Play Lost Odyssey. If you played Final Fantasy VII and you like it, play Lost Odyssey.
Don't let Squaresoft keep making games. They're just bad at it.
I'm like, look, people out there, you probably have an Xbox. Just give it a shot. You know? Like Lost Odyssey. Just give it a goddamn shot. You might like it.
When they eventually remake Final Fantasy VII in 3D, you can officially write off Square Enix as a company. They'll never accomplish anything after that point.
The last story on the Wii is a good game as well. Don't play Final Fantasy 13. Don't play Final Fantasy 13 2.
Xenoblade's not that bad.
Xenoblade.
It's a bad combat system. It's kind of like
classy video. Yeah. It's a classy game made with the old heart. It's like
it looks good.
It's made by some guys who draw a picture of a guy and go, okay, this guy is this. It's not some guys who go, this guy looks all right, but can you make his bow tie larger and his sword 6 feet long?
So I guess the final thought is that the legacy of Final Fantasy VII lives on, but not through Final Fantasy.
And yeah, it lives on
in the hearts and dreams of the children who aren't asking for a goddamn remake.
Horrible ways, and it also lives on in really subtle, cool ways that you just kind of have to look for. For example, Gears of War, I could see all the characters' heads replaced with Tetsuya Nomura characters, you know? That's what I mean. I could see them all replaced with anime heroes. And it'll work with the right lighting. You know? Thematically, I mean. So, that's something. Like Cliffy B said famously that he cried at the end of Lunar for Sega CD. Pretty sure he cried when Aeris died as well.
Why did he cry at the end of Lunar is a question I've always wanted to ask him or whatever.
I don't know. It was something.
It sucks.
Well, you see, when that game came out, Vito, you weren't old enough.
Yeah, I think I was old enough when the remake came out, though, and I played that, and I was like, "Eh, this is kind of okay."
You'd already played Final Fantasy VII. Let's face it.
That's true.
So it's like Final Fantasy VII kind of burned a lot of bridges with classic RPGs. You know, there's games like Beyond the Beyond on the PlayStation that people hated. They were just like classic style RPGs, and people despised Beyond the Beyond, and because it was not Final Fantasy VII, and they were waiting for Final Fantasy VII, and they had pictures of Final Fantasy VII in GameFan, and why isn't it out yet? I'm gonna cry, right? And Beyond the Beyond was actually a really good game. I played it just a couple years ago. It was actually all right. So that is another lesson we can take away from this, and I think that is a perfect place to end this. So I'm going to go ahead and say thanks for listening.
Yeah.
And we're going to do this again. If you want to go ahead and tweet at, we're Action Button on Twitter. We're also a video game company. We're making video games. Hopefully some of them will be pretty cool. And hopefully you'll play some of them. If you want to tweet at Action Button, and if you want to suggest games for us to do a dedicated podcast on, we three internet lords, we will try to play the game for at least an hour before we talk about it for at least an hour.
At Leave your suggestions in the comment box. Is there a comment box?
Let's make that our slogan. We promise to play the game for at least an hour.
Yes.
Or at least.
Yeah, Jaffy, you got all the way to the train. That's like
That's a couple hours in.
Good work, man.
Yeah.
Final Fantasy VII, $10 on PlayStation Network.
It's August 31st, 2012. I guess we'll record the next one at the end of next month.
So
it's only $10 for Final Fantasy VII?
Yeah, and you can put it on your Vita if you have a Vita.
And then for $40, I get an HD remake of a crappy N64 Zelda. FF7, come on.
There you go. That's it. The bottom line, Final Fantasy VII is...
good.
What would you say, Jeff, if you had to write a bottom line based on the content here?
Oh, we're doing the bottom reviews?
One-fourth as expensive as the Ocarina of Time remake.
I would say Final Fantasy VII is... usually the bottom lines are the thing I think of right off at the start. I should have totally gone into this knowing that the actionbutton.net bottom line would be a key element of this podcast. And yeah.
Final Fantasy VII is the only RPG where you'll feel comfortable dressing up your main character as a girl.
Yeah, I was about to say, Final Fantasy VII is Final Fantasy VI in a dress.
Boom.
Fantasy VI in a dress. Final Fantasy VII is... you know what, I'll just say it's one of my favorite games. If I were the editor-in-chief of a large video game website, I'd give it a 10 out of 10, and I'd start the review with the words, "Sorry, Mom."
Okay.
Good. Boom. All right, we signing off?
Yeah, that's it. Get up. Pull the cord. Cut the...